Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station all around Australia. And for those having a long weekend, we hope you've had a welcome respite from being cooped up for so long. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on The Wire today...
Tonight I can report to the people of Australia that the nation is successfully emerging from its most severe economic crisis in a generation. Unquestionably, a dramatically better state of affairs now exists than when I warned in 1986 of the threat of Australia degenerating to the status of a banana republic.
It was Paul Keating there delivering what he thought could have been his final budget in 1988. And the day before Budget Day, we take a look at the economic landscape over successive governments, from Hawke to Keating to the present day. One journalist has covered the many federal budgets since Paul Keating started overhauling the economic system in the 1980s. Tina Quinn begins by asking the ABC 7:30 Chief Political Correspondent Laura Tingle about the major reforms that Keating introduced at that time.
When you began your career with Fairfax in the early 1980s, you spent much of your time covering Hawke and Keating's deregulation of Australia's finance industry. This was markedly different from previous Labor governments, who had tended more towards economic protectionism. Can you explain Hawke and Keating's logic behind this shift?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. The times had changed. The global view of economics had changed between the time Labor was in office under Gough Whitlam and when Bob Hawke won in 1983. Monetarism was all the rage. Deregulation and free markets were sweeping the world with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. So there was a sort of an immense pressure on all governments to get with the program, if you like, and the previous government of Malcolm Fraser had sort of resisted that. Malcolm Fraser himself had been fairly grudging in moving towards deregulation, whereas his treasurer, John Howard, was much keener. So I think it became one of those things where you had to respond to events. There was immense pressure on the foreign exchange markets, which at that stage were still completely regulated. The government had to devalue the currency and then look at revaluing it. And I think that really sort of broke the back of the view of the government that they could keep Australia protected from the world. And as Paul Keating said, on the day they floated the dollar, the speculators will now have to speculate against each other, not against the Australian government. And that triggered a whole range of decisions. It meant that there are immediately immense pressures to deregulate the economy internally as well. And I think Bob Hawke and Paul Keating were just the ultimate pragmatists. I think they also had the view that they wanted to make Labor the natural power of government. It was an expression that was used a lot, to be regarded as good economic managers. And I think all of those things fed into the way they approached the task at hand.
In 1994, you published Chasing the Future, Recession, Recovery and the New Politics in Australia, which actually documented the recession of the early 90s. What were some of the conclusions that you yourself drew of this period?
Well, I think the recession was partly a result, or largely a result, of the fact that we didn't really know how to drive a deregulated economy, or the government didn't. We'd gone from a period where the government could control wages, interest rates, as well as the budget, and suddenly it couldn't do all of those things that it previously could. And as it deregulated and changed the way the financial markets worked, there was a lot of static around about, you know, what sort of impact any change in monetary policy from the government was having, and it wasn't clear that the actual mechanisms being used on monetary policy were very effective. That meant that when you got what was a repeat experience, and has continued to be a repeat experience in Australia, of resource booms and busts, the economy started to heat up. The government overdid it on interest rates for too long, and that caused the recession. Now, without a doubt, the changes that the Hawke and Keating government introduced to start deregulating the economy more broadly, through the wages system, through the financial markets and the product markets, really did set us up for the long period of economic growth that followed. But, of course, during the immediate phase after the recession, and one of the factors that became crucial in the Hawke-Keating leadership challenge was that they were sort of stuck on the mantra that you had to cut government spending, you had to have small government, you had to contract things out, sort of the same conversation that we've been having for the last 10 or 20 years. But Keating, actually having been the author and the greatest disciple and proselytizer of this argument, turned around when he became Prime Minister and said, no, we've got a recession, we've got to try to spend our way out of it, and made it a point of political difference with John Hewson, the then opposition leader. Now, it wasn't incredibly effective at the time, and it's an issue that continues to be a problem for us to this day. He was one of the first prime ministers who tried to do a big infrastructure spend to get us out of recession. But it just takes ages to get infrastructure going, and that's why, you know, it didn't really work for a number of years, and the economy was actually quite sluggish till the mid-1990s.
What also strikes me about this period and about Keating's prime ministership was that it was marked by a Treasury that changed hands about three times. So from Ralph Willis to John Dawkins and then back to Ralph Willis again. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the contribution that these two men had on Australia's economic legacy.
Look, I think they both had immense legacies, but probably not from their times as Treasurer. Ralph Willis was sort of in the job when Keating took over, but was moved aside for John Dawkins. Ralph Willis's hugest contributions to the Labor government and to Labor and to the Australian reform process came through his role as architect of the accord with the ACTU, which basically paved the way for wage restraint in exchange for the social wage. And he also oversaw a lot of the microeconomic reforms to transport and communications that were incredibly dull-sounding things, but were really important. And we saw a huge flow-on effects from those in the recession, because the recession sort of provoked a lot of change in the economy, which might have otherwise taken a lot longer. Sectors like manufacturing and textile clothing and footwear were crunched and closed down much faster than otherwise would. John Dawkins also had massive contribution, both as the minister who oversaw the introduction of what was then the HECS scheme, essentially the student loan scheme on which universities are still basically structured, or university learning is structured. And he also had a huge role to play in Australia taking a free trade agenda to the world through the Cairns Group. So they both had big contributions. As Treasurer, I think, to Paul Keating, John Dawkins' legacy, if you like, was that he was the one who had to try to make promises that were actually not financially possible by Paul Keating in the 93 election work, and he didn't, and he essentially recognised that the tax cuts had been promised wouldn't be able to be financed, and that sort of left politics shortly afterwards, I think basically prepared to take the fall for that, but I suspect a little bit bitter about it nonetheless.
Well, look, jumping ahead a little bit, 1996 was a very interesting year. So with the recovered world economy and revenue pouring in from a mining boom, and inflation's at an all-time low, and our economy has basically all but recovered under Keating's leadership. Yet the Australian electorate seemingly chooses John Howard as PM. Can you take us through the events that led to this? I understand Ralph Willis had a bit of a hand.
Well, right at the end he did. There was an unfortunate faked fax. But I think the seeds of what happened in 1996 had been sown a long time before. Now, in 1993, the electorate might have wanted to change but were frightened by John Hewson and Fight Back. Paul Keating was politically devastating in running that case about how your life would be ruined by the GST and all sorts of other things. But by 1996, Paul Keating had tried to move on to a wider agenda, which included Indigenous rights and the Republic. It was an old government by that point, and I think voters, you know, still resented Paul Keating. It had been a very sluggish return. I mean, you're sort of saying it was in the economy was in reasonable shape by 1996, which is true, but it had been a really long, slow road to recovery. So people still held him responsible for that. A lot of people didn't like the social issues he was pursuing. And, of course, by that stage, you had the rise of John Howard's black armband view of history and the sort of sense of resentment. There was that coalition slogan which really summed up the dog whistle element of it, which was "for all of us," this idea that Labor was governing for a few specialist groups and not for average punters. So I think all of those things set the scene for John Howard to basically come along and say, look, we know that you've had too much reform and you're sick of change and you're sick of being frightened by what's going to happen next. I'm going to just make you comfortable and relaxed and you don't have to worry about a thing.
You're listening to The Wire around Australia on the Community Radio Network, and Tina Quinn is talking budgetary policy with the ABC's Laura Tingle.
So do you think this was almost an early elitist backlash then? the likes of which we've obviously seen much more now in public life. Do you think this was already taking form then?
Oh, absolutely. I think John Howard basically set the framework for the way our politics has been conducted ever since. It's just got sort of filthier by the day, really. But he was a very early exponent of that. And all the talk about elites and special interest groups was really started to be played very hard in the Howard era.
It would seem that the then Prime Minister John Howard and his Treasurer Peter Costello inherited quite a robust economy from the previous Labor government. Yet it was the Howard and Costello government that ended up seeing the country to those much celebrated surpluses. Do you think the credit lies solely with their government for that period of growth and prosperity in Australia?
No, not really. I mean, they only really cut government spending once, which was in the first budget. The Howard Costello period was basically one which, as you say, was marked by this huge surge of funds into government coffers from tax, but very little spending reform of any substance. Spending basically just didn't move. They did do a tax reform in 98, and it was good that somebody finally put a GST in place, but you know, they weakened the capital gains tax. They didn't end up overseeing the removal of state taxes, which they had sort of promised to be part of it. And the GST ended up being a very narrow base because they couldn't get it through the Senate. And I would argue if they had been sort of more determined or had been less contemptuous of the Senate, they probably could have got a much better GST, which would have been fairer. So overall, I think that they were the beneficiaries of a lot of the reforms of the previous era and of an economy that had started to really take off on the back of the growth of China.
Peter Costello's last budget in 2007 predicted that the world economy was expected to continue to expand at a strong rate and that the US's economy in particular would grow by 3% in 2008. Well, as we all know, it instead fell by 0.1%, which was the beginning of the great global financial crisis, before falling a further 2.5% in 2009. Australia was the only major Western economy not to fall into recession. How did the then Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, and his Treasurer, Wayne Swan, keep our economy from toppling over?
Well, they did a lot of things which, you know, the current government has now done which and said that it was crucial to do it, but at the time, of course, the coalition poo-pooed a lot of it. I think you do have to separate out the various bits that Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan did. Without a doubt, their go hard, go early, go household strategy of basically putting cash into people's pockets sort of kept the economy ticking over and stopped the really important thing, which is the collapse of confidence. And their first package of measures, I think, was a success. So, you know, people can criticise individual things about, you know, checks to dead people and things. When you're in a crisis, as we've seen in 2020, you basically have to run policy fairly hard and fast and, you know, not look too much at the details. The second package, the $42 billion package, I think probably ended up being marred by the fact that Labor were saying, well, we've got an opportunity here to transform a lot of things, including the education sector. And I think as a result, there were changes made to what was originally a good plan, which made the government vulnerable and left them open to criticism about stimulus. And I would particularly single out the school halls program. Absolutely fantastic idea in principle, because it involved getting money out to every part of the country because everybody's got a school hall. But it gradually was changed as people got a bit more ambitious, and instead of it just going to places where it was particularly needed, it was money for everybody. A lot of projects weren't as worthwhile as others, and that was sort of symbolic of a lot of the things they did which weren't very well thought through and which had a very long lag tail, and that sort of took away from that sort of sense of a really successful stimulus, and also meant that spending was much higher, which was always going to be harder to bring down. But without a doubt, I think the success of keeping the economy out of recession and stopping hundreds and thousands of jobs being shed was one that they should always be credited with.
Paul Keating once famously said that Peter Costello was hit with a rainbow up his ass when he...
Kicked up the ass by a rainbow.
Yeah, exactly. That was obviously in reference to the booming economy that Costello inherited from the Keating government. What sort of economy did Wayne Swan inherit from his predecessor?
Well, they followed the great Labor tradition of getting into office just as things went pear-shaped, as Gough Whitlam did. Of course, Bob Hawke took over at a time of economic crisis and drought, but he ended up, of course, miraculously bringing about the end of the drought, as the joke went, so they did a little bit better. But without a doubt, timing didn't work well for Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan, and they sort of knew that from the beginning. As you say, it was starting to turn already. And, I mean, you were mentioning the Costello budget forecasts. Of course, basically, Howard and Costello, in those, not just in the budget, but in the election campaign, set off on this huge number of rounds of tax cuts, which basically were designed to empty the tills for Labor. And also, they set in place a structure of the tax scale which has been almost impossible for subsequent governments of either persuasion to easily change because of the way they set the tax system up, or the income tax scale up. It's very hard now to do tax cuts and target them at any particular group. It's a really unwieldy system, and that doesn't stand their reputations in good stead.
You're listening to The Wire, and it's the ABC 7:30 Chief Political Correspondent Laura Tingle there. She's been talking with Tina Quinn about successive governments' economic management. Tina now asks Laura Tingle about the current government.
Now we come to 2010, which was the beginning of what would become a decade of turbulence in Australian government. Kicking it all off, there was a coup in the Labor Party, which saw Julia Gillard replace Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister. Wayne Swan, of course, continues as Treasurer. Kevin Rudd then takes back control of the Prime Ministership in 2013, only to be voted out by the Australian electorate in favour of Tony Abbott and the Liberal Party. Joe Hockey is then our Treasurer, followed by Scott Morrison when Malcolm Turnbull ousts Abbott in 2015. And then Morrison himself takes the Prime Ministership in 2018 from Turnbull. And for the last 2 years, we have had Josh Frydenberg leading our Treasury. So how do you think the Liberal Party's management of the economy has been over the last 7 years?
Well, I think the beginnings of the current coalition government, if we date it from 2013 and see it as a continuity, was a debacle and was really a problem of people, of a government not recognising a change in the times. You know, they came in very sort of, having said they weren't going to cut anything, but with a really very hardline ideological bent. If you look at speeches from Tony Abbott, sort of before he became Prime Minister, they were saying, well, you know, the New Zealand government didn't have to spend all this money to get through the global financial crisis, and you know, we don't have to spend lots of money. Well, of course, it's true that New Zealand also actually went into a recession, but that's a minor point. So I think the first budget of the Abbott-Hawke era was, I think, universally seen as a political and budgetary debacle. It was not well thought through. It was savage, had a terrible ongoing impact on a lot of people who could least afford it. And I think you could then see the next 3 or 4 years of coalition budgets as absorbed by trying to overcome or rectify or reverse what they'd done in that first budget because it was even too bad for them. So we lost a lot of time and momentum for getting change in the country in an economic sense because of that mess. Subsequently, they've been doing a bit. And I think Josh Frydenberg has, you know, really sort of done not a bad job of trying to keep a reasonable line, though, of course, there was the, you know, ridiculous thing about being back in black before they were actually back in black, the obsession with the surplus, not being prepared to move with the times and say, well, you know, we're actually in this period of really long, of low growth around the world. You know, you've actually got to start thinking differently about what the role of the budget is. And I think the government internally has been too consumed by the culture wars, which has really hamstrung it. And as I mentioned before, John Howard left this legacy of a tax scale that was really difficult to do anything about, which really stymied Malcolm Turnbull's attempts to change tax regimes when he became Prime Minister. So I think it's a government that, in an economic sense, likes to talk really big about reform, but in fact hasn't been prepared enough to actually look at the times around it and change with them and say, well, you know, there are different roles for government. And I think we see that now in you know, the pandemic response. yes, they came out quickly and did what they had to do. But I think ever since then, they've been struggling to find a sort of ideological and intellectual framework for how they go forward. You know, they still want to do tax cuts because that's what you do, even though most economists will say that that's not the right solution. So I think it's just that lack of flexibility of thought that marks the coalition's economic management since 2013.
Yes, I think they definitely jumped the gun a bit with the back in black. I'm still confused as to why Julie Bishop put on the blue sequin dress. So, in great celebration. Frydenberg repeatedly refers to Labor's debt, claiming that we as a nation are still paying for their expenditures and alleged mismanagement.
But when you actually look at the numbers, I mean, our debt has climbed from $234 billion in 2013, after 6 years of Labor, to a record-breaking $684 billion after 7 years of the Liberal Party's management. And that was before this recession that was obviously spurred on by the pandemic.
I tend to see the levels of debt as a bit of a balancing item, if you like, yes, which don't just reflect the government of the day does. Part of it does. I mean, obviously, high levels of government debt reflect the fact that we've had two major economic crises now. And as you say, those figures might have been before the current one. But you rack up huge amounts of debt when you've got an economic crisis. You can argue about how much you should have racked up, but you rack it up. But most importantly, we've had an economy that has been growing below average for some time, along with the rest of the world. And that just means your capacity to earn revenue, to pay off debt is reduced. And that's sort of just the way it is. And I think, that will also be the case around the world for, some decades to come, until almost inevitably inflation lifts and reduces the value of that debt, because I think that's what's going to happen. So I've never subscribed to the view that you say, oh, foreign debt's grown by X amount under one particular government or another. You've also got to look at how much money households are borrowing, how much money corporates are borrowing. Yes, you can sometimes have profligate governments, but I think overwhelmingly the sorts of levels of debt we've seen have not been because of government profligacy. This has been a 30 or 40 year era where people are always just talking about small government. It's been about the economic conditions and having to cope with economic crises when they've come up.
Laura Tingle, this has been so fascinating. I have one last question for you. Now that the guillotine has officially fallen on our economy and Australia is in a recession, instead of slinging mud, do you think Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg could actually learn from previous Labor governments that saw us to recovery during the last number of economic crises we had? Do you think they could learn from them on how to manage our way out of this?
Well, you'd hope they could learn, whether it's from a Labor government or a coalition government. And in fact, so much of what they're talking about doing comes straight out of the playbook that Paul Keating used in 1992-93, because, but in some ways that's not rocket science. It's what governments do in the post-Keynesian era when these things turn up. If you look around the world, governments around the world are making the same sorts of decisions. The more interesting question will be, I think, whether they gradually change their role of their view of the role of government in an ideological sense, because at this stage they seem to be stuck in some undergraduate university club view of commies and capitalists, which is profoundly depressing and which doesn't help us. We need a more sophisticated view of what governments can do in a digital age. It's not necessarily about lots of public servants. It's about being smart and using your resources the best way you can see, whether it's by using your opportunity to build community housing, because that is infrastructure that's quick to get going, or whether saying, wait a minute, universities are our fourth largest export earner. We need to be protecting them and building them up, both as an export owner for the future and as a source of research that we need in this extraordinary time.
The ABC 7:30 program's chief political correspondent, Laura Tingle, speaking there with Tina Quinn. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or listen to our podcasts. The Wire is a team effort from 4EB in Brisbane, Radio Adelaide and 2SER 107.3 here in Sydney. And you can hear us around Australia on your radio, courtesy of the Community Radio Network, or online weekdays. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, and in Sydney produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation, and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well, and thanks for your company.